Hi, friends, and welcome to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where each week we share an idea in the Parsha and how it relates to Jewish history, along with all of the books and articles I've read over Shabbos to learn more about it. A reminder to sign up for our weekly email that you can access through Substack. Just a weekly email, nothing scary, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com. Substack is spelled S-U-B-S-T-A-C-K. readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com, where you can get a write-up of our weekly class, along with all the links to the articles and books that I've discovered on my Shabbos reading journeys. Thank you so much to our friends and sponsors, Janet and Lior Hoden family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. Our Parsha, in many ways, feels like a crime scene. The deaths of Nadav and Avihu, which takes place in the 10th parak of Parshas Shmini, two of the sons of Aaron the Kohen Gadol, can be approached like an unsolved murder mystery. In the 10th chapter of our Parsha, we are told that the sons of Aaron, Nadav and Avihu, take a pan and offer a foreign fire, an Esh Zara, that God did not command. Seemingly, as a punishment, a fire swallows both of them up. What exactly were they punished for? There are lots of clues, but much of the evidence is contradictory. The plain meaning of the text seems to suggest that they were punished for the foreign offering they brought. But why was that punishable by death? Were they ever told not to bring such an offering? Given that the plain meaning of their sin, that they brought a foreign fire, has such a glaring question, namely, as the Rashbam himself points out, that such a fire was normally brought, many other commentators focus on other clues and give other explanations as to what was the sin of Nadav and Avihu. Rashi cites some of the other opinions. Rabbi Eliezer says it was because the sons of Aaron issued a halachic ruling in front of their teacher Moshe. Rabbi Yishmael attributes their punishment for entering into the holy site of the Mishkan while they were drunk. Each of Rashi's explanations have their own clues as well. The emphasis of the verse that the fire was not commanded suggests they disagreed with Moshe about the proper commandment. The suggestion that they were drunk perhaps derives from the clue that the verses following the story present the prohibition of drinking wine before serving in the Mishkan. The Medrash quotes four possible reasons why Nadav and Avihu may have died. Perhaps it was serving while they were intoxicated, not wearing the proper clothes for Kohanim, not washing their hands, and deliberately deciding not to have children. In fact, the Chida, in his commentary Psachei Nayim, on the discussion of the Gemara in Erevin on Daf Samach Gimel Amud Beis, which talks about the sin of Nadav and Avihu, quotes six possible reasons, all of which, the Chida writes, are hinted in the very words Eish Zara from our Parsha. He writes as follows, Shamati Remez Na'a, I heard of a beautiful allusion in our Parsha, Vayakrivu Lefnei Hashem Eish Zara, they brought this foreign fire. Eish Zara, Aleph Shin, Zion Resh Hey, is an acronym, Shehu Roshe Tevos, Eish Zara, the Aleph is for the foreign fire, the Eish. The Shin is for Shesuye Yayin, that they were drunk. The Zion is for Zera Shelo Hayilahem Badim, that they didn't have children. The Resh is for the Rechitza, that they didn't wash their hands before entering. And the Hay is for Horu Lifnei Moshe Rabbeinu. They made a halachic decision before Moshe Rabbeinu. So he has this beautiful allusion that Eish Zara, which our Patuk says, is actually an acronym for all of these different possibilities. With so many clues that lead to so many different explanations, one should rightfully wonder if there is any underlying theme that can account for all of these different approaches. In other words, what was the actual underlying issue that caused the deaths of Nadav and Avihu? To understand all this, let's explore some of the stories regarding the toll of searching for insatiable spirituality may have had on some Hasidic leaders. Professor Ariel Evan Mays, who happens to be a wonderful person, is one of the most gifted contemporary research on Hasidic thought in the academic world. His Tour de Force article entitled Like a Moth to Flame, The Death of Nadav and Avihu in Hasidic Literature, explores the tension between the insatiable longing for God and the countervailing commitment to this actual world. Alongside of Norm Macdonald's famed moth joke, these are undoubtedly in the pantheon of moth-related content. Again, his article, Professor Ariel Evan Mays, is called Like a Moth to Flame, The Death of Nadav and Avihu in Hasidic Literature, and of course, I link to it in our email that you can get on Reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com. The article begins as follows. It's a fantastic opening. Undersea divers know of a dangerous and mysterious phenomenon felicitously described by Jacques Cousteau as, and this is in French, so I'm going to butcher this, Livres de Grandes Profondeurs, or, you may be familiar with this, the rapture of the deep. This state, also called nitrous narcosis, often manifests as a sensation of overwhelming euphoria akin to intoxication. Faced with intense pressure, likely compounded by a chemical imbalance from breathing ordinary air so far beneath the ocean's surface, the body and mind begin to flex curiously. In this rapture, the diver's judgment and vision become hazardously impaired. This sub-aquatic bliss is all the more dangerous because it may lead to an inscrutable longing to go deeper, overruling the panicked instinct to surface. Cousteau noted after a 1951 dive that I could see stretching temptingly below me, as far as my eyes could reach, what seemed the infinite sweetness and quiet of a blackness that would yield up the secrets of the universe if only I were to go a bit deeper. On that occasion, Cousteau's instinct for self-preservation prevailed, but he later acknowledged that this brush with limits of reason and mortality transformed him forever. And the combination of physical pressure, the feeling of rapture, and the sweeping undersea expanse have tempted other divers into continuing their journey, even as prudence calls them to return. This phenomenon, the rapture of the deep, has parallels in the religious world as well. There is a longing to remain in an ecstatic or mystical state of divine euphoria that can sometimes impede on some religious seekers' ability to remain grounded in reality. In Drs. David Greenberg and Eliezer Witsum's fascinating book, Sanity and Sanctity, Mental Health Work Among the Ultra-Orthodox, they explore the phenomenon known as Jerusalem Syndrome, a breakdown in mental health experienced by some who visit the holy city of Jerusalem. I remember hearing these stories. I remember seeing people. I'm like, they probably got Jerusalem Syndrome. Encounters with holiness and transcendence have the capacity to upend our very grasp of reality. Jerusalem Syndrome, the author explain, is comparable to Stendhal syndrome, named after the author Stendhal, a pen name that was used by Mary Henry Bale, whose novel describes the frantic excitement of someone viewing art. Their heart begins to pound, thought racing, they're like running through a museum, and they kind of lose their own mind. Similarly, as Greenberg and Witsum explain in their book, the sanctity of Jerusalem has an effect on its guests that, for a few of them, has very unsettling consequences. It is always a tricky endeavor ascribing very real psychological conditions to historical figures. We've discussed this in the past. This is especially true when considering the lives of mystical figures, people immersed in divinity where it's not always clear where divine engagement ends and unhealthy, unhinged unions begin. As Gershom Scholem, the great scholar of Jewish mysticism, once remarked, in treating the history and world of the Kabbalah, using the conceptual terminology of psychoanalysis, either the Freudian or the Jungian version, did not seem fruitful to me. Interestingly, as Zev Elef points out in his Worth Reading a Second Time article, we've quoted it before, Psychohistory and the Imaginary Couch, Diagnosing Historical and Biblical Figures, and we have a link to it. It's on his academia page, I believe, or maybe it's, I have it to JSTOR. This is a must-read article. It is the most fabulous, enjoyable scholarship I ever remember reading, really, truly. Scholem, however, did not always follow his own advice. Scholem's biography of Shabtai Tzvi, the mystical messiah, 1626 to 1676, is littered with psychological speculation. Whether it was schizophrenia, paranoia, or his manic euphoria, as Scholem describes it, Scholem did not really follow his own advice. He didn't abstain from considering Sabbatean messianism through a psychological lens. Scholem's contradictory approach to applying psychological speculation to mystical activities was not lost on his book's reviewers. Notably, Salo Baron expressed deep discomfort with psychological analysis of such figures and incidents, a sentiment he expressed in response to Mortimer Cohen's book on Rav Yaakov Emden, Jacob Emden, Man of Controversy. Again, all of this is in Zev Elef's fantastic article, Psychohistory and the Imaginary Couch, Diagnosing Historical and Biblical Figures. In short, my friend Zev Elef concludes his treatment of the psychological analysis of Shabtai Tzvi, Sabbatean scholarship has by and large ignored ignored the advice of Salo Barone, who was the great chair of Jewish studies at Columbia University. They've ignored the advice of Salo Barone to steer away from reconstructing psychohistory from a finite number of documents that may or may not capture the total personality of the deceased historical figure. It was not just subversive figures like Shabtai Tzvi who invited psychological speculation. Many other more mainstream Hasidic personalities had their lives and mystical works considered through a psychological lens. One notable example, of course, is Arthur Green's biography of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, Tormented Master, The Life and Spiritual Quest of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, which by the author's own admission considered much of Rabbi Nachman's mystical ideas through the lens of his own personal psychological struggles. I reached out to Professor Ariel Evan Mays, whose aforementioned article, Like a Moth to Flame, on Hasidic interpretations of Nadav and Aviv. I found it so fascinating. I asked him, who are the Hasidic leaders who you had in mind when you were writing this article? Meaning the article presents all of these different Hasidic approaches to explaining the story of Nadav and Avihu. But I was wondering if there were any actual Hasidic leaders whose lives actually embodied the potential unraveling as a result of the pursuit of spirituality. His response did not surprise me at all. He mentioned two Hasidic leaders, each of which I had also assumed were intimately familiar with the toll that their relentless pursuit of unbridled spirituality can take. Namely, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Morgenstern, known as the Kutzker Rebbe, who lived from 1787 to 1859, as well as his once disciple, which we'll discuss in a moment, Rabbi Mordechai Yosef Liner, known as the Ishbitzer, who was born in 1801 and died in 1854. Let's begin with the Kutzker Rebbe. The Kutzker Rebbe was known for his unrestrained pursuit of truth. As Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel describes in his fantastic book, A Passion for Truth, which is all about the Kutzker and Kierkegaard, he begins by describing so beautifully the intensity and the chaos of the Kutzker's personality and Torah. He writes, "The Baal Shem Tov dwelled in my life like a lamp, while the Kutzker struck like lightning. To be sure," he writes, "lightning is more authentic. Yet one can put confidence in it. One can live in peace with a lamp." Where he's basically saying the Baal Shem Tov was like this comforting lamp that provided light. The Kutzker was like lightning. It's fiery. It upends things. It turns things upside down. Truth, however, which the Kutzker Rebbe was known for, that unbridled commitment to authenticity took its toll on the Kutzker Rebbe. In the winter of 1839, as legend would have it, the Kutzker publicly violated Shabbos and spent the rest of his life in seclusion. It's a fascinating tale, deeply upsetting to adherents of the Hasidic movement. How could a Rebbe renounce God at the end of their life and then go into seclusion? Did the Kutzker fly too close to the flame? As Professor Morris Feierstein explores in his article, The Friday Night Incident in Kutsk, History of a Legend, the truth behind this story about the Hasidic leader who so championed unbridled religious truth, the truth of this story is not so simple. While the Kutzker did indeed spend the end of his life in seclusion, perhaps due to some sort of breakdown, the actual desecration of Shabbos seems entirely dubious. More likely, as Feierstein argues, the story was exaggerated by opponents of the Hasidic movement for polemical purposes to highlight the more enlightened Maskilic movement. As Feierstein concludes, the legend of the Friday night incident seems to have arisen from a convergence of the fact of Menachem Mendel's seclusion, we're not arguing with that, the rumors circulating about the reasons for the seclusion, and Bear of Levo, who's one of the original people who circulated the story's embrace of Haskalah. An examination of all of the available evidence shows that the legend of the Friday night incident has no real factual basis. How it came into existence and gained popularity remains a subject of speculation. Rav Mordechai Yosef Liner was a student of the Kutzker who broke off from Kutzk and established his own Hasidic court beginning in the year 1839, 1840. Heyo, it was on Simchas Torah of 1839 into the year 1840. And yes, that is in part why my podcast is actually called 1840, because I consider myself a student of one of the students of the Kutzker, namely Reb Tzadok, and his Rebbe, the Ishbitzer, began his Hasidic court in the year 1840. 1840, a very auspicious and important year. We have explored more in depth a different time. I think Parshas Noach. The Hasidic school of Ishbitz was in many ways a reaction to the fiery world of Kutsk. The Rebbe of Ishbitz emphasized the ability to access divinity in all facets of life, even moments of distance and religious failure. This emphasis on divinity in all aspects of life can also be a dangerous one. As Morris Feuerstein writes in his book, another book, on the thought of the Ishbitzer Rebbe, the name of the book is called All is in the Hands of Heaven, the Teachings of Rabbi Mordechai Joseph Liner of Ishbitz. Professor Feuerstein explains, there is an inherent danger in Mordechai Joseph's teaching that the purpose of mitzvos is to bring man to an awareness that all is in the hands of God. The language that the Ishbitzer uses, which is a play in direct contrast to a line of the Gemara, where the Gemara says, Hakol bidei shemayim chutz meyir shemayim. Everything is in the hands of heavens except the fear of heaven. The Ishbitzer writes explicitly, Hakol bidei shemayim, everything is in the hands of heaven, afilu, even yira shemayim, even your awe and fear of heaven. And Feuerstein writes, for example, is the person who has already attained this level of understanding still required to fulfill the obligations imposed by the commandments? It could lead to antinomianism. If God is everywhere, then even my diminished religious capacity is also from God. Even my sins can be from God. When Rabbi Mordechai Yosef Liner's teaching were first published by his grandson, Rabbi Gershon Henochliner, in the work Mei HaShiloach, a warning was appended to the introduction. V'ha'amnam ki yadati ki b'kama makomos yikshu ha'devarim la'aznayim asher lo shamu v'lo hurglu b'devarim ke'ela ach lo asafti bilti l'man anche shlomenu ha'mekirim erech yikarusam. The ideas contained within, cautioned Rav Gershon Henoch, can be difficult to understand and apply. Therefore, the cautionary note explains, this work has only been published for the sake of our intimates who understand their true value. This is one of the only Hasidic works that begins with almost a religious surgeon general's warning. It's like a pack of cigarettes. Be careful. These ideas can be dangerous. As I wrote in my own book, Synagogue, Sin and Failure in Jewish Thought, in chapter 4, What to Wear to a Sin, Negotiating with Sin, when Hasidic theology is extricated exclusively from text, divorced from its communal context and ambience, radical suggestions suddenly become more plausible in some circles. Without the tempering effect of the communal environment, Hasidic texts can seem deceptively radical. When misapplied or misunderstood, mystical ideas and experiences can be dangerous. Which brings us back to our parsha. Nadav and Avihu were drawn to God. They wanted to become close, but they became too close. The Midrash describes their actions as an attempt to add love upon love. Amdu, in the words of the Sifra, Amdu lahosiv ahava al ahava, love upon love. They wanted to experience divinity. They ended up being consumed by it. And this explains the underlying issue for all of the diverse explanations for their sin, whether it's rejecting the normalcy of familial relationships, never establishing a family, or their intoxicated spirit jumping ahead and not asking Moshe Rabbeinu because of their excitement. Nadav and Avihu allowed the pull towards the flame of concentrated divinity to ultimately consume them. And that explains a remarkable connection between the story of Nadav and Avihu and the Havdalah service performed after Shabbos. As my dearest friend, Rabbi Ben Greenfield, once shared, the Havdalah service thematically mirrors the story of Nadav and Avihu. Listen closely. Both involve fire, both involve wine, both involve spices, and both are performed after the seventh day. The story of Nadav and Avihu, of course, occurs on the eighth day after the inauguration of the Mishkan. It's Motzei Shabbos, so to speak. Think it's just a coincidence? The very phrase we say in Havdalah, Hamavdil ben Kodesh l'chol, separating the holy from the profane, is taken from the story of Nadav and Avihu as well. Ulahavdil ben HaKodesh ubein HaChol. Rabbi Greenfield was the first to share this connection with me, but he is not the first to see the connection between Havdalah and Nadav and Avihu. Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, no stranger to the allure Brewer of Mystical Union writes this explicitly. In Likutei Halachos, in the Laws of Interest in Hilchos Ribbis, which were recorded by his student Rabbi Nassen, Rabbi Nachman says, V'al kei nismach inyan zeh shel havdala lemisas b'nei Aaron, ki heim pagmu bazeh shehasru lalos el hakadusha shehu b'chinas emes lefnim meimadre gusan, v'af al pi she nidma lahem shekavanosam el haemes avol shagu bazeh, kemefurish batorah, nimsa shepagmu b'bechinas sod havdala, al kei nismach pasuk ulahavdil lemisasam. Nadav and Aviu is a cautionary tale of becoming too close. Life cannot be lived exclusively in the inner sanctums of the Holy of Holies. We need Havdalah to remind ourselves that there is divinity to be found even within the rest of the week, even within our mundane lives. Just like we make Kiddush to sanctify Shabbos, Reb Tzadok, a student of the Rebbe of Ishbitz, describes Havdalah as the Kiddush we make to sanctify the rest of our week. It's the Kiddush we make on the Yemos HaChol, on the other 6 days. That even separated from unrestrained holiness, whether it's Shabbos, whether it's that burst and pull towards the spiritual energy of bringing that Eish Zara, that foreign fire like the Nadav and Aviu, this entire story reminds us that even separated from that unrestrained holiness, divinity can still be found. Before we wrap up, I'm just going to make one more brief addendum. You could stop listening. I mean, you shouldn't. You want to go to the very, very end. But one very quick addendum that I included also in our weekly email. Since we discussed the Me'ah Shilach, it's worth noting that the Rebbe of Ishbitz points out that our Parsha contains 91 verses, which is the numerical value of the two names of God, the Shem Havaya, Yud, and then He, and then Vav, and then He equals 26, and the name of Adnus, Aleph, Dalet, Nun, and then Yud, the name Havaya is 26, and the name of Adnus is 65, equaling 91. The sin of Nadav and Aviu, the Rebbe of Ishbitz explains, was that they could not merge these two perspectives, the transcendent name of God represented by the name Havaya, and the more personal God that is revealed through the normalcy of life, which is the name of Adnus, my God, which is literally Aleph, Dalet, Nun, Yud, is conjugated in the possessive. It's my God, the God that I experience every day of our lives. Our Parsha contains 91 verses as a reminder that we need the experiences that each respective name of God represents to always be integrated and merged with one another. So thank you again for listening to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha. To get the links to all the articles and books mentioned, be sure to subscribe to our weekly Substack, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com. Thank you again to our dearest friends and sponsors, Jan and Lior Hoden family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. Thank you so much for listening, and keep reading each and every Shabbos.